Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery. Cain Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cain5.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half hour of culinary history. And, you know, trends come and go. And interesting, I think once Sex and the City had an episode about Magnolia Bakery and cupcakes, the next thing we knew, cupcakes were everywhere, all over the city and every town in the U.S., and cupcakes were the new craze. Well, now all of a sudden, seems like the cupcake has a competitor because we're seeing a different kind of shop pop up all over at least New York City, and that is a shop of selling macaron, the wonderful confection from France. Well, do we think it's a trend? Do we think it's the new cupcake? I don't know, but I've got a couple of experts here to talk about it. Today I have with me the authors of a just published book called Les Petits Macarons, Catherine Gordon. Catherine, who is an instructor, pastry instructor at ICE, the Institute of Culinary Education, and she's been a pastry chef and trained under some of the great French chefs such as Jacques Torres, for one, and Anne McBride, Anne, who is an author and has co-authored several different books and particularly on pastry, and is an instructor in the food studies program at NYU and has been at ICE. She is now the culinary program and editorial director, strategic initiatives group at the Culinary Institute of America. Welcome to both of you. And I'm sad to say you didn't bring me any macaron.
We ate them all.
I figured as much. What do you think? What do you attribute? I mean, truly, there are nobody knew of macarons except, oh, they popped up every now and then in a tea shop or at a French bakery. You would find them on the beautiful color, looking like Easter eggs, you know, lined up on a pastry shelf. There really are now suddenly shops opening up everywhere. What do you make of it?
Well, I teach classes on macaron, and people say that they first saw them usually in France, a lot of people, and they got to know them, and they're just so eye-catching and colorful and pretty and small that as soon as people see them, I think they want to taste them and learn how to make them or learn more about them.
Yeah, and
I think also that Americans have gotten more and more into pastry, and you know, after cupcakes, macaron is sort of a little more sophisticated little sister. And that has added to the appeal, the fact that they can still have a one-unit piece of pastry, but it's something a little more grown up.
Yeah. Well, in fact, many of them are. They're so little. The little petite ones, as you say in your book, Les Petites. You can pop one and not feel too guilty, as opposed to that cupcake that has a mountain-high, you know, pile of icing on it. For people, listeners who might really not know what a macaron is, Catherine, can you tell us what is it, what goes into it?
Well, the French macaron have a cute little, I call it a UFO shape, where there's a skin dome kind of an effect with a little foot, which looks to me like UFOs are supposed to look like. And they're usually sandwiched, but not always together with a filling. The American, what we think of as macaroons, are usually made out of either coconut or almond paste, and maybe a little bit chewier than most French macaron, which are a little bit lighter in texture, but they don't form that little foot.
A little foot. So in other words, it's like if you were to press down, it's like the filling squishing out from under a dome lid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's really, for those who are gluten intolerant, it's the perfect treat because they're gluten-free, right?
Yes, they are. And I think that may have, Catherine knows more about that in terms of what she's seeing of, you know, the students who are talking to her about macaron all the time. But I think it's contributed a little bit also with so many people now following gluten-free diets and having food intolerances, but still wanting to have their cake in a sense. And so that's allowed them to do that.
Because there really are only four basic ingredients?
Yeah, it's very simple. It's egg white and then some sort of a nut. Traditionally, it's almond flour, but it could be any other kind of a nut ground up, including actually coconut, which isn't really a nut, but it's like one. And we give recipes for how to grind your own nut flours, like from pecan or pistachio, and sugar, and it usually includes both granulated and confectioner sugar.
Interesting.
They're fat-free also, until you put the filling.
Yeah, right, until you put the filling in. And if, I mean, fat-free, but not calorie-free. I mean, sugar has calories. Okay, fat, that's not bad.
Hey, you pick your battle.
Yeah, that's right. I was noticing that there are so many different sizes of them, too. Large ones, small ones. Tell us a little bit, and traditionally they're made with almond flour. So what I want to know is, tell us a little bit about the history of macarons. Where did macarons come from?
You can find a lot of sources that say that they came to France with Catherine de
Medici.
It's
not Catherine de Medici. We know she's blamed for everything,
she's,
right?
She's brought everything. Earlier sources really trace the appearance of macaron and anything with almond flour or almond product, basically, to the Venetians and to the Arab bringing almonds also. So you can find traces of macaron type recipes to about the 8th century. And then at some point, it was also a savory filler, in a sense, something that would add a thickener to dishes. It's also, the etymology of the word tracks it back to Italy and a dish with cheese. So it was initially, I think, something quite thick that appeared in a lot of dishes. And then by the 17, 18, and for sure a lot in the 19th century, you start seeing the cookie. And in the 19th century, there's a lot of recipes, and there are also a lot of sources that talk about macaron vendors on the streets of Paris. It was made a lot in convents in the Middle Ages because for nuns, doing confectionaries was a way of making money. You know, they couldn't really sell anything, but they could sell honey and pastries and things like that. So they made a lot of macaron. There's a whole lot of lore in France that talks about nuns and pastries, and in particular macaron.
And they were nutritious too.
They
had a lot of nut filling, so it was a nice substitute for other dishes that they were not eating.
Exactly. Right. And then the macaron, the way we think of it now, the very colorful sandwich with a filling, a cookie, that comes from La Durée, which is a pastry shop that opened in Paris in, I think, 1852.
And they just opened a shop in New York, too.
They did, on the Upper East Side. And they initially did not sandwich their macaron. And that came later, probably in the early 20th century, is when a filling started to be added. Mm. You would find macaron sandwiched together, but with no filling in the middle. And Pierre Hermé actually was here in New York last week, and he said that the early macaron he was making at Fauchon, so in the 70s, 80s, they didn't put a filling either in between them. They just sandwiched them like that. Yeah.
I've just put the cookie together. Well, I know in Italy still, I mean, you said something about, of course, the Moorish influence, the Arabs in Venice, and tracing it back to Venetian backgrounds. And we know that in early Roman history, I mean, almond milk and ground almond flour was always substituted as a nutritious, not always, but began to be used quite a bit and substituted for their nutritious value. And in northern, not a Venetian treat so much, it's actually in northern Tuscany, the ricciarelli. And ricciarelli are pretty much like a macaron. I mean, it's an egg white and sugar and almond paste cookie that bears a bit of resemblance to a macaron as well. So I'm wondering if this is just kind of the offshoot or drawback.
I think that there's a lot of like relatives of the macaron, and there's many that have almond paste as their base. And I tried to research it, and it's funny because people call them different things, and they can be called either Danish, Dutch, or Northern style. There's some variations within them, and then also when you use like the bitter almond and bake it a little bit more crisp, you get like the amaretti kind of a cookie. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely other relatives, but with the paste, it doesn't typically form this little foot shape thing. But by switching it from the paste form of almond to flour, very, very finely ground nuts, it will help you make this characteristic shape of what we call the French macaron.
I think also it's a texture, you know, in addition to the foot. A big difference is the fact that a lot of these cookies, including the ones you were mentioning in Italy, have a much rougher surface. They don't have that fine...
It's almost like a gloss. It's like this smooth, glossy dome.
It can be very shiny. And so even when they were using ground almonds rather than almond paste, they were doing it with a mortar and pestle. So you never got the fine texture that you now have with commercially processed.
Yeah, you get the oils really come up.
Right. Yeah, and it's very hard to get them to get the flour as fine as you can if you're just, you know, buying it commercially processed.
Yeah, it is the texture. Talk about the texture, because you look at these beautiful little confections and you're not quite sure what to expect, right? I just adore taking one and, you know, if it's been freshly made and kept, you know, in the right conditions, and we can talk about that too, is, you know, biting into it, and there's initially that crunch, but then it kind of melts into the smooth texture, the soft texture.
I mean, I think the interior after the crunch, it's almost like the crust kind of catches your tooth just for a second or two, and then you're in a moist, delicious, flavorful interior. Anne and I talked about it a lot, you know, because when you eat a lot of them, they're not all the same. And like one of the things I do is actually take people on macaron walking tour around Manhattan. And I've done various ones in Paris, too. And they're just so different from each other, even though they have a similar appearance to it themselves. But the interior should be moist as well as flavorful, not really chewy. If it's like really chewy, I don't think it should. It's not quite as good as it should be. Could be.
Right. Right. It's interesting. It's like, you know, think of anything, chocolate chip cookie or a brownie. I mean, you could, the varieties are endless. So I would imagine, as you're right, you taste enough macarons in your excursions and you will taste the differences, even though they all seem to look pretty similar. Right?
Well, I got interested in it in the first place because, I mean, it is only four ingredients. But to me, like, the highest ranked pastry chefs in the world really don't agree on how to combine the four silly ingredients together. So I just found that interesting. So I started to study it, like, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, and collect recipes from various people. And one of the things that they do differ on is how they put the egg whites and sugar together, which is called making a meringue. And there are different meringue bases that one does use for a French macaron. But even within that, you can find texture differences. Because I know some people, bigger producers around Manhattan, who are making them. And, you know, even if somebody uses what we call like a French meringue method with egg whites and sugar not pre-cooked before it goes to bake the cookie in the oven, they're not the same texture.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's still different.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more and more in depth about how to. In fact, we'll give our listeners a how-to, how to make a macaron, when we come back after this short break. We'll be right back. We are back on A Taste of the Past. I'm talking with Anne McBride and Catherine Gordon about their new book, Les Petits Macarons. And you no longer have to go to Paris to taste them. They're all over the United States now, and you can make them at home. Not you could still go to Paris if you would like, but the music brought me back. Catherine, we were talking, you were saying the differences in the types of meringue that people would make that changes the outcome of the macaron. So I want to really have you bring us through like a little walkthrough of how to. But before I do that, I wanted to ask, Aunt, do you know in the history, were macarons always a sweet confection?
No, they were not. Well, they were always a sweet confection, but they were a savory preparation early on, you know, with cheese and things like that. And they were used in savory dishes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was still in the 17th century. You can find sources that talk about it as a savory item. But in terms of once it became a confection only, or it evolved really into something that we ate as a sweet.
Right. But I know what I think is marvelous is that you include savory preparations in your book, some different recipes for savory. Catherine, give us a couple of examples of what some of the savory recipes would be in the book.
Well, one of my favorites is with a foie gras, actually, which, you know, I said to the editor, I said, do you realize you're putting foie gras into a cookie book? You know, and it's foie gras in the first place, but it's with a blackcurrant gastrique with a caramel reduction and cassis, and it's really delicious. And I started to think about like savory fillings that kind of paired well with a little sweetness to them. Mm-hmm. And then that's like how that evolved into basically a whole chapter that we have on savory fillings.
But now do you keep the cookie base? Do you alter the amount of sugar at all?
I do alter the amount of sugar. You do rely on some sugar to stabilize whipped egg whites. Uh-huh. It will collapse at some point, and so you can't take it out indefinitely. But we, you know, did a lot of recipe testing for the book and tried to decrease the sugar as much as possible. Just because, I mean, like, you know, some people actually think that macarons are very sweet. So, you know, a lot of people like to buy them with the sweet filling. Also, like a little bit on the tangy side, you know, a lemon right. curd or a
yes.
passion fruit.
Yes, yes, I love that. You know, or the salty caramel. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's wonderful, too. Well, all right, so give us a little walkthrough of how to. Because I know a lot of people are intimidated when they think about, oh, I couldn't possibly make this beautiful confection at home.
Well, it comes down to basically, in some form or another, you're going to whip egg whites, and you're going to have sugar added to those egg whites. And then you're going to fold in or add in sifted dry ingredients, which are powdered sugar, confectioner sugar, and the ground nuts.
Uh-huh.
That's the batter. It can get more complicated than that. And there are four different approaches that we put in the book. And in case this is confusing, Anne and I actually made a video to try to give people a summary of like what are the main macaron meringue methods, you know,
and
that, French.
And actually, it's a great video. I did happen to look at it, and our listeners can look at it too. It's on the website of the book. It's lespetitsmacarons.com, right? And then you can find the video on there. Mm-hmm. That's great.
I think it summarizes it as well as anything.
I thought it was excellent. Yeah.
What it boils down to is just those four ingredients.
The basic technique is just that. It's very basic, and there's no equipment that a home baker wouldn't have. And then there's little things, you know, piping is pretty important and really affects your results.
Something I thought was, I mean, as I was watching the video, yes, there are four basic ingredients and you whip together a meringue and then you add the flour. But, you know, it's the point at which you stop whipping and Catherine explained this because that I found very interesting there, you know, when it folds over itself, it's not three-dimensional. Go in, not three-dimensional. I mean, you tell people not three-dimensional, they go, what is she talking about?
Well, you know, usually, like, if you make a mousse or something, you're combining non-homogeneous ingredients together, and that process is usually referred to as folding, and it's included in this cookie. But this cookie keep folding. You fold past any other point I've ever seen for anything else. So the batter starts to move. Some people, like, they refer to it as lava, or something like, you know, flowing of the earth. And you can see the batter move in front of your eyes. And when you see that, what that means is simply that when you actually deposit the batter, the cookie or pipe it, or even we tried it with a spoon or an ice cream scoop, if someone hates piping, it will kind of make a round shape, not like a mountainous three-dimensional shape, which will be ugly.
And I love how Catherine always talks about it as a counterintuitive cookie, because you've spent all this time beating air into the egg whites, right, and then you completely deflate it.
That's what caught my attention. Because usually when you fold, they say, when you fold in the ingredients after you've beat, you know, a nice meringue up, the egg whites up, you carefully fold it in so it's not deflated, so that you just barely combine the ingredients. And you're saying, no, keep folding. I'm watching the video, and in the folding process, as you see, it's an over and under, and the dough then falls on top of itself and on top of itself again until, as you say, it's not two, three dimensional. I finally got what you meant. I mean, that it doesn't hold its shape up there. It eventually melds in together into the whole dough.
When it softens out, then you'll have a pretty macaron.
And then it's piped on. And how... And then an important step for those of us who are familiar with piping batter onto a cookie sheet and putting it in the oven. But there is one very important step after you pipe it onto that cookie sheet, a rather aggressive step. But
yeah, this isn't a batter that you have to be particularly careful with. Like you can be pretty fearless with it, you know, in terms of the folding and manipulating it. Anne and I even tried like baking it later, you know, it's like you're really, really getting rid of the air. And I've seen some people in production bakeries around town, I've seen them hold it for 45 minutes. So, you know, it's not like you have to, you know, immediately run to your oven, but the, you don't want the interior of the macaron to have a little air pocket. And that sometimes happens to people if they don't know what little tricks to look for. So, I picked this up along the way, saw people slamming the sheet pan. Like, you know, it's not gentle tapping. No. It's very, very aggressive, as you
said.
And
noisy.
Yes. So that will help you if you actually aren't very skilled at piping. It completely makes the cookie look beautiful. And it also eliminates any problems on the inside.
You actually take the sheet pan and just whack it on the countertop several times. Right?
And it allows you to see if there's a problem with the batter, because if it doesn't settle in a position, if the tail remains, for example, of your piping, when you bang it, if that doesn't settle out, you can repipe and sort of smooth it out, you know, before you bake and you've ruined your entire batch of macaron.
Okay, well, it sounds simple when you describe it, but for getting in your own kitchen and making it, I'm sure there are a lot of trials and errors. But you said one thing you advise people, Anne, is you do not make these for the first time if you're bringing them to company.
Yes, and I have to apologize to friends who have gotten not so great looking macaron. They were delicious, and I've eaten a lot of not so great shells, and they make really great cookies on their own. But if you're expecting to bring friends a nice box of macaron of tons of colors, maybe practice a little bit before.
That does need a little bit of practicing, right?
I think your very first time, you need to know what your oven is doing, because even a brand new oven or a commercial oven does really not, it has like hot spots. They don't run as even as they're supposed to. So if you could just make the batter and pipe a couple and bake them and see, did it work? Are they going to make the right shape? Are they getting brown on one side because your oven is hot on the back left corner or whatever? Then you don't have to waste your time or the price of the nut flour, and you can actually make some adjustments if you need to, and then you'll have a more successful batch.
All right. Now, it's interesting because I know how books are produced, and you had to have started working on this book quite a long time ago. And it wasn't all that long ago. You're shaking your head. They're shaking their head saying, no, don't go there. Okay, so it was a quick production book. But since the time that you began, I mean, literally three or four different shops, macaron shops, must have opened since then. And we talked in the beginning of the show, the top of the show, about, you know, what do you attribute this sudden craze? How did you get the idea? How did you conceive of the idea to write a book all about macaron?
Catherine and I were talking about what project would make sense. She had been thinking about what book to write for a long time, and we're, you know, brainstorming. And it's like, your macaron classes, because I was writing the copy for the newsletter in which her classes appeared, and I was seeing, you know, each newsletter there was more and more of those. It's like, what about that? What about macaron as you know, something that you have in you? And Catherine's like, oh my god, I have spreadsheets and spreadsheets all about macaron. So I think that's how
idea
it started.
Was born.
Because I mean, I started making them, I think it was 1995 at the Rainbow Room, And then, you know, from then on, I've just been collecting recipes from various, you know, people I've worked with, taken classes with, you know, mostly French pastry chefs, but not completely. And just, like, I just got fascinated, like, how people could combine four ingredients together completely different from each other, from the making the batter stage and the procedure all the way through to how they baked them. Yeah. Nothing.
Forget agrees. About the fillings.
Yeah. I mean, so to me, that was just interesting, like almost like academically, just to kind of figure that out, why and how and where the, you know, what was going on there.
And so you've been teaching the macaron classes at ICE, at ICE for
about 8 years.
Wow.
And they have grown in popularity. We've added sections on the web, and they've had wait lists of 16 people within 3 days. It's crazy. And like, just I think there's about 12 different formats now that I teach.
Oh, interesting. And of course, Anne, you've got that pedigree of being French and Swiss, so
it's in my DNA to eat.
I was going to say you had to have been the taster, right?
Yes, indeed. I had an extensive tasting experience of macaron when we started on the project, so that was a great excuse. For the last year, I've just been eating macaron everywhere I found them, and now it's for professional reasons, really.
Yeah. Right. Okay, tell me also what there are so many. I mean, the fillings are limitless, right? I mean, come up with an idea and put it in between the wonderful cookies, and the colors are gorgeous. Are those tints? Are they flavors? What gives the macaron the different pastel colors?
I think what's different about the approach that I took was in writing the recipes was, you know, that you could develop flavor through the actual batter itself. Because there's no liquid in the batter, so it's not like you can, like, add lemon juice or something. That would sabotage you. But the some commercial places, like, buy things that we call concentrates or compounds. But that's not so accessible to the home cook, although we do give a resource section so people could find, like, licorice flavor. But, you know, to me, a home person, you can grind your own nuts. I mean, it takes some patience, but you can do it. So, like, if, I don't know, you inherit a macadamia farm and you want to make macadamia macaron, you can. Now, a commercial bakery won't do that because the cost of the other nuts is more than the almond. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't make as much of a profit. So they rely more on food coloring, and we eat first with our eyes.
Right.
And then if you're seeing something and it says it has pistachio filling and it's green,
you think
the cookie right. is pistachio. And in our book it is, but it isn't necessarily out there in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people do use food coloring, and we do too. One thing I found is, you know, when you see these intense jewel tones that have gotten very popular with macaron, or black for licorice, that's usually a powder. It can't be a liquid because you would just need too much water, which isn't good for the cookie. And some people, but not everybody, can taste it almost on the back of their tongue.
Hmm.
So, you know, it is not for everybody.
I see. What are some of the more unusual fillings that you have experimented with and tasted?
Oh, God.
Or they're in the book. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all, you know, the book has a really great balance of sort of classic macaron fillings, like, you know, salted caramel or some ganaches, but then there are a lot of more unexpected flavors. I think the popcorn pastry cream, you know, that's a really great
and does
recipe.
It really taste like popcorn?
It really does. The first time Catherine made me taste it, I just couldn't believe it. She had been talking about it so much, and she wasn't lying. That was just amazing.
Is it like a buttery popcorn flavor or a caramel popcorn flavor?
No, it's more buttery, I guess, in a way. Yeah, because it's got, like, it infuses in the milk.
Oh, that's wonderful.
To make the pastry cream, so yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And so what is your favorite, Catherine?
That one actually is my
favorite.
That's your favorite. I mean, I also like ice cream sandwich macaron. So I like the chamomile ice milk one, which is made with chamomile tea infusion.
There's one shop that opened up specifically just with ice cream sandwich macarons. I think that opened up last summer, a year ago. Maybe they're closed by now. I don't know. Boy, the ideas, as I say, are limitless. Anne, do you have a favorite?
I have a few. It's hard that I don't like a macaron, but I think the lemon marmalade with Campari and the apricot vanilla jams are two of my favorite. Really.
The Campari and lemon, that would do it for me.
I kind of eat it with a spoon if I make it.
Well, it has been really interesting. Thank you both for coming. I didn't know that macarons were going to take off. I mean, it's what's not to like about them? But who would have ever guessed that they have become so popular? And I think, indeed, they might be the new cupcake. Thank you both, Catherine Gordon and Anne McBride, for joining me. And once again, their new book from Running Press is out. It just came out last week, and it's called Les Petits Macarons. Join us again for A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. And thanks to our producers, Carlos Serrera and Jack Inslee.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Feel to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com.